I really wondered whether we could sort of start by you're telling me quite what Kathleen Courtenay's distinctive contribution is really to the international movement, to the League of Nations Union particularly. What do you think she actually gave to the organisation?
Well, she brought the women's movements behind it, and that was very important. The UNA has never been what the League of Nations Union was before the war, when she came into it first. The League of Nations Union was a very powerful body, and powerful in the sense that it influenced government action. And the peace ballot of 1934-5 was incomparably the most important non-governmental political movement in Britain, or in my view anywhere else, since Cobden's Anti-Cornwall League, Cobden and John Bright. The union had 500,000 members, 600 branches, one in every parliamentary constituency, all of them active. It had 80,000 subscribers to a monthly journal, Headway, which was a very high-class production, and very good education in all international and league questions. And the consequence was, in every branch, there were a lot of people who knew what they were talking about, who could badger their members of parliament, who could write to the local press, who could write to the national press, and who could organize a great movement like the Peace Ballot. And have you ever studied the Peace Ballot?
Yes, oh yes, it's a very interesting, it's the most ambitious petitioning organisation, really, that ever has been, I think.
It was terrific. Kathleen Courtenay had a lot to do with it.
Did she?
She was just coming in. I don't remember her exact participation.
Yes.
But it was run by a woman who lived in the house on the corner opposite.
Oh, yes.
Dame Adelaide Livingstone.
Yes, I've heard the name.
Who'd been made a dame because of her work for the Red Cross in the First World War. She was an American. And she became the principal organizer for the Peace Ballot. And she had a little office in the Mews behind the League of Nations Union headquarters in Grosvenor Crescent. And all women are good organizers because they do everything, not once, but twice. But Adelaide Livingstone was a super organizer because she did everything, not twice, but three times. And in consequence, everything was done at least once. Nothing was missed.
Yeah.
And we raised £100,000 for the Peace Ballot campaign, the printing, the meetings, and so on. From subscriptions at meetings, from miles of pennies, from collections in churches, nearly all in shillings, half crowns, very few large subscriptions.
Women are in key positions in the League of Nations Union, are they? I mean, you've noticed that, did you, at the time, that women were very important in the organisation?
Oh yes, they were.
Yes, it's interesting. Why, do you think? Because they have this capacity to deal with detail.
Yes, I think that was very important.
Yes, yes.
There were a lot of women secretaries of branches, very effective ones. Oxford University kept the Oxford kept the paid secretary, Gilbert Murray's granddaughter, who is married now to a professor of economics in Oxford, what's his name, a great friend of mine, who was in Cambridge.
You mean Merlies, do you?
No.
No.
She was one of the very competent secretary, but there were lots of women secretaries of branches and women members of committees who were very good. And in the ballot, Robert Sisson got 39 organisations together in a national committee, which approved the six questions and the general lines of the campaign. And then in every town and county and hamlet, there was a local committee with a parson in the chair or somebody of equivalent status. And they produced the Labour Party, MSA, came in, and the regional organisers were very helpful indeed to Cecil. He used to speak very warmly to some of them. And the Liberal Party came in, and some Tories, John Power, Lord Queensborough, or Queenborough, whichever it was, and the co-ops came in, the churches in a big way, because Cosmo Lang was the Archbishop of Canterbury and a great friend of Robert Cecil's, an Oxford friend. And we got 500,000 canvassers who went to every house in the country, and if they didn't get an answer at the first visit, I mean if they didn't get the questions filled in properly, it was usually a second visit, because they took the ballot the first time and said, this is what you have to do.
Yeah.
And sometimes people signed right away, but usually they said, we'll take it and talk to our families. And then one, two or three or more of them signed, according to their ages. And their canvassers used to go 2, 3, 4, 5 times if they didn't get the papers back.
Did you have women canvassers very much, or were they mainly men?
Well, I wouldn't remember that. Both, of course. I remember a story of a woman canvasser, which was true. I was assured it was true from a London area. She was canvassing and went going home to tea or lunch and got on a bus. And she found a young man sitting next to her who had the ballot paper in his hand and was reading some stuff about it. So she immediately started canvassing, talking to him, found he was rather recalcitrant and not very inclined to answer all the questions, yes. Then she got the place where she had to get off, and she'd only got to question 3. And as she got off the bus, the conductor leaned out and said, it's all right, miss, I'll fix him. He's got a 9-penny ticket. I had myself a very similar correspondence, a very similar experience.
Yeah.
I spoke at a ballot meeting in York, and the next day I had to go on to Darlington. I went down to the train after lunch and settled in, and the train began to move, and then it suddenly stopped. And the porter came running along the platform, Mr. Noah Baker, said, no. So I leaned out and said, yes. He said, oh, the station master wants to speak to you a moment. And the station master came in top hat and tail coat and said, oh, I'm so grateful to you. I was out canvassing last night and I got in great difficulty over question 6. Could you tell me what you would have said? That was the scale of the thing.
Yes, yes.
And we shall get some when we get it again.
But do you think women were important in the organisation behind the scenes of all that then?
Yes. I'm sure they were. Yes. Adelaide Livingston was a live wire inspirer of constructive action everywhere. I don't remember how many women there were. There was a certain Nancy Bell, whom I mentioned again in another connection, who worked for the League of Nations Union youth movement, who was very good, as I remember, a young and rather pretty girl. And she, I remember her being very good in Dame Adelaide's office, and among the youth people at that time, 34, 5.
Why do you think women are so active in the peace movement, being the wars or the League of Nations movement? I mean, what is it?
Well, women are superior beings. They have better brains, better bodies, better physique, better morals, better character, better temperament, better athletic ability, better grace and movement than men.
You think they're more evolved in a way than men are? They're higher up the scale?
Yes, they're higher up the scale. Than chimpanzees and baboons and then orangutans and then men and then women. It's like the Russian cavalry officer, first as God, then there's the cavalry officer, and then there's his horse.
But Kathleen Courtney's contribution was more in the way of speaking, really, wasn't it? Lecture tours and that sort of thing.
Well, I wouldn't say that. She went to Geneva to the disarmament conference of 1932. Betty Furlong must have told you about that.
Yes, a little, yes.
Oh, well, she was very important in Geneva because the women's organizations had played the major part throughout the world in organizing the biggest petition that the human race has ever conceived. There were scores of millions of signatures to the petition. Holland had about a population of about 7 million at that time, 7.5, something, that's 8.5 now, I think. It was about 7, I suppose. And my memory is that they got 4 million signatures, which is everybody over the age of 18.
Yes,
which was the minimum age of which people were allowed to sign. And they took great precautions over not letting people sign twice and making them understand what they were signing before they did it, and so on. And in Geneva, on the opening day, women from 50 countries, I don't know, all over the world, brought scores of millions of signatures, and a lot of them were dressed in national dress. And they carried in their petitions in enormous baskets, two and two, one on each side. They were very heavy. And they took them up in the middle of the hall and dumped them in front of the president in front of his dais. And that was a very important part of the proceedings. And that was entirely a women's organization. Mm. I don't think any men had anything to do with it at all. Mm. And Kathleen Courtney went actually in Geneva as coordinator of all the women's organizations who were represented there. And there were quite a lot of them. She was the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. There was the American League of Women Voters. And there was the Towns Women's Guild, women co-ops, of course.
And the International Women's Suffrage Alliance, I suppose.
I should think undoubtedly. Mm. And co-op women's guilds. And I suspect that the International Cooperative Alliance had a good many women there, but I don't know that. Anyway, I know there were agents of a number of organizations in Geneva, and Kathleen Courtney acted as coordinator of what they did and helped to organize their visits to delegates, deputations, to make the delegates vote straight on. Whether it was the abolition of tanks or the abolition of battleships or whatever it might be, she kept up to date with the current discussion in the commissions and in the assembly, and attended herself and understood everything. And then she made notes for the women's organisations and what they ought to say to the delegates and the kind of thing they ought to do. And that was throughout the whole time of the conference. That was very important, particularly in the first 6 months. And it was a very vivid hope of it succeeding.
She was a good organiser, was she? I mean...
Oh, she must have been a wonderful organiser. Mm. I never came across that side very much of her because I knew her much best when she was getting very old.
Did you really?
Mm. But she worked with the suffrage societies before 1914.
Yes. Yes, she had.
Proved that she must have been the best woman organiser, I think, in the country.
Mm. And, but she also was getting people to work together, really.
Yes.
Yes, coordinating.
Yeah, very good.
Yes, yes.
In her later years in the UNA, she was extraordinarily good in discussions, particularly on disarmament, because she always knew the back documents. She always knew what resolutions the General Council of UNA had adopted 5 years before, 10 years before, or the year before. Nobody else remembered, but she did and could always produce it. And she often blew up the anti-disarmers by, of whom a certain Peggy Crane, who was the example of everything a woman ought not to be, who doesn't deserve the name of woman at all, but was a kind of lower breed, far below the chimpanzee. Peggy Crane was a perfect horror, and she filled UNA with anti-disarmers and really broke the organisation up. In my view, she was primarily responsible for its very rapid decline in the 60s and where it is now.
But Kathleen Courtney had a very good memory then, very clear memory.
Very clear memory.
Yes.
Very good indeed. And very keen appreciation of principles and of the point of policies. How, what it really meant in international affairs and why you didn't get what you ought to have got and how you could have got it and so on. She developed a very stubborn and all-pervasive dislike of the communists, and she was always very suspicious of anything in which the Russians were concerned. And I used to try to persuade her that Khrushchev was by far the greatest statesman of the post-war era, and that after Lloyd George, or with Lloyd George, the best Prime Minister I've ever met or seen. And certainly the international statesman who made the greatest and most best sustained campaign for any public object that of any politician in my lifetime. Khrushchev's 10 years campaign for disarmament was like nothing any other.
Mind you, Brezhnev seems to be equally interested in reduction of armaments, doesn't he? I mean, there's a lot of initiative coming from Russia now, isn't there?
Well, I hope so. Mm. I don't feel that this is one thing I don't really forgive them. I had a great feeling for Khrushchev. I only met him once, but that was for 3.5 hours. Mm-hmm. And I read his speeches for 10 years and heard him on the radio and followed his adventures in America, and I always thought he was an extraordinarily sympathetic as well as a remarkably clever man.
But you couldn't convince Kathleen Courtney?
She would admit that he was much better than other people, but she had an ingrained suspicion of anything that had the approval of the Kremlin.
Why do you think that was, actually?
I think she went through the same experience that a lot of British trade unionists have been through. will find that I was great friends with Citrine, whose name is Walter Citrine. You may remember
Walter Citrine.
He was General Secretary of the TUC for many years and became the chairman of the Central Electricity Authority when it was nationalized. And I was very fond of Citrine, had a great regard for him. But he had a passionate dislike of communists. And the reason was that they had such an appalling persecution by the communists in the union branches. They would become members of the union, you couldn't refuse their subscriptions. They attended the meetings, you couldn't keep them out. They stayed on when everybody else left to go home to tea or supper. They ruined the early part of the proceedings by highly contentious and meaningless propaganda attacks on the labor leaders, trade union leaders, whoever was important on the labor side in that particular branch. And for the first 2 hours of the meeting, nothing serious was ever done. It was just one long shout. I suffered this in the local labor party before the labor party turned them out. And I suffered it in Coventry. Horrible, it was horrible. And then when after 2 hours everybody had gone, seven or eight of them remained and elected their chairman, elected their delegates to this, that and the other, and a very small minority became the voice of the union, of the movement.
That happened in the peace movement as well as in the labour movement?
It happened in the League of Nations Union.
Did it really? In the late 30s?
After the Spanish War began.
Did it?
And unfortunately, the communists infiltrated as they quite a lot from the Oxford Union, Oxford Labour Party, the thing I told you about. And the Gail Nancy Bell, whom I mentioned, is a characteristic case. There was a very strong case for turning communist in the 1930s. And very few people understand Maclean and what was the other
Burgess.
Guy Burgess. And I knew them both. And very few people appreciate what really happened to them. They went up as undergraduates to Cambridge at the same time in 1929. The League of Nations, very strong, the country pretty prosperous. For 3-4 years while they were undergraduates, the unemployed increased from 1 million to 3. The country fell into the most appalling disorder. No government had any idea. The Labour government was much better than anybody else and did a number of constructive things. And the foreign policy were extremely good for 2.25 years. But the Tories blackguarded them by saying, 10 unemployed every minute since the Labour government came to power, whatever the figure was, something like that. And they plastered this all over the walls everywhere. And British capitalism was obviously breaking down. And instead of helping the unemployed, the best the Labour government could do was to reduce their unemployment allowance by half as a so-called economy measure, what we now call a cut. Mm. In other words, the insane policy of deflation.
Yes.
Which has failed for the last century and which is failing again today, as it always has done. Although they give it different names now, it's just the same
thing.
Three. and it gets nowhere. Mm. And in addition, the League of Nations, which had been very strong, had settled a great many disputes, had kept Russia out till the year 1934. And in 1934, when we were frightened of Hitler on one side and the Japanese militarists on the other, we let the Russians come into the league. And and Dane and Burgess were quite clever enough to see that we only let them in when we were damn well frightened and thought we could get their soldiers to die on our behalf. And they came in 1934. And in 1935, Mussolini began his war on Abyssinia. And of the leading powers in the League, Russia was the only one who wanted to uphold the covenant and stop Mussolini. The British people wanted to. The peace ballot gave a 93% majority for economic sanctions and an 80% majority, an overall 80% majority for military sanctions. Only 8.8 million people voted instead of 11.5. A lot of them shirked the question. But as Sissing always said, you must assume that if they'd been compelled to vote, they would have divided roughly as the others had done, and that you would have had an 80% majority for military sanctions overall. And in any case, 8.8 million people gave an 80% majority for military sanctions, which meant that the country were overwhelmingly for it. But Eden and Halifax and Neville Chamberlain and Sam Hoare having given an absolute pledge that we would stand up for the League, having gone to Geneva and said, my country stands, as our public opinion has just confirmed in a great declaration, for upholding the covenant against aggression. And they called a general election in order to renew their mandate on the wave of League of Nations feeling. And they issued a manifesto in which the opening words were, in the matter of Abyssinia, there would be no wavering.
And then they went back on it almost immediately.
While they were saying that, while the election was going on, Robert Van Sittert had sent a man to Lampson, to Paris, to negotiate the Hoare-Laval Agreement, which appeared. It was published in the middle of December. And Hoare, poor man, went to Paris to sign it. He was very exhausted, and everybody agreed he must have a holiday. So he went on from Paris to Switzerland, where he was going to have a winter sport holiday. Do you know this story?
No, I didn't know this one, no.
And he was a very keen ice skater, figure skater. So he went to Davos, or whatever it was he favoured, and he started ice skating and fell and broke his nose, and was immediately summoned home by telegram, because the Hoare-Laval Agreement had been leaked by the French. He was supposed to keep it deadly secret. The French leaked it, and the fury of the British people was such that they had to hurl Sam Hoare out of office. And he was brought back from Geneva. And he appeared in the House of Commons with a broken nose and went to the third bench below the gangway, which is where resigning ministers stand, and got up and made a speech explaining why he was resigning. And dead silence, and then walked out of the house in dead silence and out of the side. And the post office authorities recorded that the members of parliament had the biggest mail they'd ever had, all in protest against the Hoare-Laval Agreement. I attended in a meeting in Coventry, where I'd been the parliamentary candidate in 1935 and been beaten. And the election was in October, and this meeting was in December, as soon as the Hall of Val agreement was published. They got up a meeting at short notice in what was called the Central Hall, which held about 3,000 people. It was back to the doors at 24 or 36 hours notice. I can't remember whether it was Lytton himself, somebody important from the League of Nations Union came and made a fierce denunciation of Sam Hoare and the betrayal of Abyssinia. I had to speak for 5 minutes moving a vote of thanks. I was cheered to the echo. The successful Tory candidate who defeated me and was member for Coventry tried to defend Sam Hoare and was howled down. He'd been elected 6 weeks before. And they wouldn't listen to him at all. Anyway, why did I embark on
this? Well, the reason was we were talking about why Kathleen Courtney moved to the right later in life. Do you think it started in the late 30s then?
I think it started in the late 30s because, but I still don't understand why I started talking about the feeling about Abyssinia.
Well,
in any case, the Union was very, very strong.
Yes.
And then the Communists began infiltrating the youth movement. And one of the prominent people who led them was this Nancy Bell, whom I told you about.
She became a communist.
A communist. She was converted, and she converted a lot of other of the young people. She was very pretty and very attractive. A very nice girl, really, until she became a communist. And then they carried on in every kind of way. She began to have a baby and had an abortion and boasted about her abortion and I don't know what. And I think all that turned Kathleen Courtney very strongly against. I wouldn't like you to quote Nancy,
no,
by the way.
No, I won't quote anything.
Because for all I know, she may be alive.
Mm. But
a good deal younger than I am. I expect she is alive. Mm.
But Kathleen Courtney moved to the right on a number of issues, didn't she? It wasn't just on communists. She was further to the right at the end of her life, wasn't she, than she was as a younger woman?
Well,
or was it just on that one
issue? I think it was mainly on that.
Mm.
She was as keen a disarmer at the end of her life as ever.
Oh, yes.
And as keen for the UN to succeed. Mm.
When you were talking about her on committees, you said she had a very good memory.
Yes.
How did she behave in committees? I mean, was she very active, very talkative, very dominant?
Well, she was like most women who know their job. She talked when she had something to say, and not when she hadn't. She never talked too much. She never interrupted anybody else who was saying something sensible. And she would cut short somebody who was running a red herring. She was chairman of the UNA committee, executive committee, for some time, and a very good chairman. Her deafness became a great burden to her. And she was always, in the end of her life, unhappy that her hearing aids weren't as good as mine. I think the answer was that while I was fairly deaf, she was even deafer. But I, in fact, did not have very good hearing aids until I got a National Health one. The one I'm using now is extraordinarily good.
Mm.
And I had a box one, which I use as a reserve still if the battery of this one runs out, which was extremely good. But the private enterprise hearing aids I had before were not very good and let me down badly in the House of Commons.
Did they?
Compared to what I have now.
Because her great strength, in a way, is not just her memory, but her logical power, isn't it? I mean, she's
yes.
a very logical sort of person.
Yes, very.
Did that lead her to be impatient with people who were not so logical, do you think? Did she...
Well, I should think internally, yes. But she never was impatient in a sense that other people could object to. That you would say, she spoiled the meeting, or why did she do that? You never said that.
Yeah.
But I don't think she suffered fools very gladly. I think that's true.
So if you wanted to assess her contribution to the League of Nations Union, and later the UNA, it's partly a thinking function she has. I mean, she thinks things out and is good on principles, as you say.
Yes.
It's partly that.
Yes.
It's partly an ability to speak in public.
Yes, she was a good speaker.
Was she?
Yes, she was a good speaker.
Was she?
And when she was 90, exactly 90, they had the celebration meeting in the Central Hall, Westminster, for the 50th anniversary of the passing of the suffrage bill. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And whoever was Prime Minister at the time...
Lloyd George. Oh, you mean...
No,
you mean
The 50th anniversary.
Oh, that would be...
Harold Wilson.
Yes, Wilson, yes.
And who would be his opposite number then? Ted Heath, I suppose.
Yes, that's right.
And Grimmond.
Yes.
All took part, and I don't remember who was in the chair.
Yes.
But they hauled Kathleen Courtney out and made her come. She was just 90. And I wasn't at the meeting, but it was packed to the doors, I understand, with all the political leaders there. And they said she made much the best speech of the evening, by far. Mm.
She had a good carrying voice, did she?
She had a good carrying voice. Mm. She could be heard very well. And I expect she talked about the organisation of the non-militant suffrage movement in the early days and about the broad general principles, no doubt. In any case, her speech had a very great success. Mm. And she was 90. Mm.
How do you feel she faced up to old age, being old? I mean, what did you have any impression about that?
Well, it was a burden to her. And of course, at the end, she became very much handicapped. Worse even than me.
You don't give the impression of being handicapped at all.
I'm dreadfully handicapped. She fell. She kept on falling, as everybody does. I do. I haven't fallen for a little while, touch wood, but I set myself back a lot of times. I fell on Vienna Airport and I didn't see some steps down in front of me. I damaged my elbow and gave myself an arthritic arm about 4 years ago. She was handicapped by that. She broke her hip and was in bed for a long time. Movement became rather a burden to her in her very last years, when she was 93, 4, 5.
I think Miss Furlong told me that she was such a rational person that she got annoyed with herself when, because she was old, she couldn't do things. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, indeed. I know.
She got irritated with herself.
Yes. I think she did, up to a point. Mm. And deafness undoubtedly was a great trial for her. Mm. And she would sit in meetings trying to hear, and in fact not hearing. Mm. And I think she used to leave the meetings rather with a sense of defeat. Mm. And Eric Bice Holmes or someone would drive her home. Mm. But she went on trying to come, really, when it was not much use to her or anybody else. That was out of sheer devotion and desire to show her adherence to the cause.
So she really fought old age, you think?
Yes, oh, she did.
Yes.
But, and she was marvellously successful till she was over 90. Mm. she took a very effective part in the meetings in the, particularly in our UNA disarmament subcommittee against this Peggy Crane. She disliked communists, but she disliked Peggy Crane quite as much.
Can you, she, one of her major functions was being a chairman of meetings, wasn't it? She was very often the chairman of,
yes,
of meetings. How did she play the role of chairman? I mean, how did she, how was she in the chair? Can you describe that at all?
Well, she was very good. I think she was just a good chairman. She made appropriate comments on the items that came up. If she differed from what the meeting was saying, she said so. When she thought there was a consensus, she said so and got it written down. When she thought a vote was required, she took a vote. When the minority opinion was deserved to be recorded, she got it recorded. She didn't let people waste too much time on items that were unimportant. She moved them on to the next thing. If she had something she was particularly concerned about, she tried to hurry the business on till that came. In fact, she was just a good chairman, that's all I'm saying.
She was just in control. Really.
Yes, she was in control. Yes.
Did she have a sense of humour, do you think?
Oh, yes, very much so.
Did she? Mm.
I don't know whether I can give you examples of it, but she certainly have.
Because that can be quite important in,
yes,
chairing a meeting, can't
oh,
it?
Oh, yes, it can.
Another strength of hers was her great conscientiousness, it seems to me. She was very thorough, wasn't she? Very,
yes,
well prepared.
Yes, always.
Always.
Always. She read the papers before the meeting. She always knew every paper that was sent out for a meeting.
Did she?
And exactly where to find what. Always. Yes, she was very, very conscientious and conscientious in carrying things out after a meeting that she'd agreed to. I don't remember her actual participation in the peace ballot. I come back to it because I think it's so immensely important. But she'd had this very high level and significant piece of work in Geneva in coordinating the women's organizations in their lobbying and canvassing and reporting to their home organizations of the conference, of the disarmament conference. And she held all that together and kept the women's organizations very effectively aware in every country of what was going on and what was going right and what was going wrong. And the peace ballot was 18 months, after 2 years after that. And unless I'm greatly mistaken, she was already on the executive committee of the League of Nations Union. Perhaps you know when she joined it.
No, I don't know that, but I can find that out.
It would be worth finding out.
Yes.
But the decision to go on with the ballot was made
not to worry, I mean...
I'm trying to remember, it's the autumn of 33 or the autumn,
yes,
of 34.
Yes.
I was at Yale in the beginning of 34. So I came home in June. And I wrote the memorandum on which, in fact, the executive decided to go forward on the peace ballot. And I got Megan Lloyd-George to support it when a lot of members of the executive were saying, we think we'd better drop this, it looks too complicated. And do you know how it all started?
No.
Well, there was a... after the Manchuria fiasco when the Hawks let the league down and let the Japanese get away with Manchuria, quite unnecessarily. And after the disarmament conference failed, thanks to the action of the Hawks began to say loudly in the press and elsewhere, wherever they could in this country, we ought to leave the league, Britain ought to leave the league. We ought to say we are never going on with this silly disarmament nonsense. It's been proved to be a failure. We ought to make it clear it's wasting time and money to hold these conferences and talks. And a member of the union who edited a newspaper near the Crystal Palace, one of those, Norwood, is there somewhere called Norwood?
Yes, yes.
Well, I don't know what his paper was called, but let's say it was the Norwood Sentinel. It was a weekly.
Mm.
And he did a lot of propaganda articles against the Hawks and defending the league and saying the disarmament conference could and should have succeeded and so on. And then he was very much upset by these demands that Britain should leave the league and so on. So he decided to take an opinion poll of his readers. And it was in fact more than an opinion poll, it was an educational effort because he'd been writing about it for a long time. And I think I'm right in saying that in September or the beginning of October 34, he published in his paper three questions and invited his readers to cut them out, to write in the answers, cut them out and post them back to him. And the three questions were, should Britain remain a member of the League?